This is Herb Montgomery of Renewed Heart Ministries, and I want you as a listener to know that we at RHM take seriously the words of Jesus in Matthew's gospel, "Freely you've received, freely give." We feel that in a world where everything is now monetized, the teachings of Jesus should remain free from capitalistic entanglements. And how can we charge money for that which Jesus taught for free? So we've chosen as a ministry not to make any money from the resources that we offer, including the seminars that we conduct in various venues around the globe. And in order to do this, we are therefore dependent on our supporters. If you'd like to become a supporter of Renewed Heart Ministries, there are different ways that you can, and I'll tell you how at the end of this presentation you can do just that. But for now, it's our hope that your heart will be liberated, healed, and renewed by this as our gift to you, till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Many voices, one shared table, one new world. Thanks for listening.
All right, I want to invite everyone back in. Try to get you out of here. Maybe in, what do we got? Maybe in half an hour, would that be good? Can we try for that? Shoot for that? Three reasons Jesus remains relevant. I came up with these off the top of my head, a little bit of help from a couple other sources, this is just a from the hip kind of a stab in the dark. This is not a conclusive list. These are just the ones that are valuable to me. You could come up with a different list, I'm sure. But the first reason I think Jesus is relevant to us today are the actual teachings of Jesus. Number one, we've been talking about it for almost an hour now, is his teachings on nonviolence. These are testable. These are you can witness them. You can see repeatable results with Jesus' nonviolence. Gandhi has proven it. MLK has shown what it can do. Others have as well that have built on their work, but both King and Gandhi both attributed at least their interest in nonviolence to Jesus' teachings on nonviolence. Jesus' preferential option for the poor, his enemy love, his universal benevolence, his idea of a God that's kind to the wicked. That's so anti-Christian. Luke 6:27-28, that sends his rain on the just and the unjust and the sun on the good and the evil. Mercy, Jesus is teaching on mercy. Jesus is teaching on forgiveness. Dear friend of mine, Eva Moses Kaur. Anyone know Eva Moses Kaur by chance? Her documentary is on Netflix. I got a chance to spend a day with her a couple years ago hanging out, just her and I. She was one of Dr. Mengele's twins at Auschwitz. And she is traveling the world today. She is one of the most beautiful humanists I've ever met. And she travels the world teaching people the power of forgiveness and how she was not liberated from Auschwitz on the day the liberation forces brought her out. That did not happen until she was 50 years old when she learned how to forgive Dr. Mengele. And it's just a powerful documentary if you haven't seen it. Forgiving Dr. Mengele. But Jesus' teachings on forgiveness. Jesus' teaching on restorative justice for the oppressed. We've talked about that a little bit. Jesus' teachings on the redistribution of wealth, freedom from anxiety. That's appropriate for today. Healing versus condemnation. We talked about that a little this morning. Jesus' teaching on inclusivity. All of these are values. These teachings are relevant in our world today. Shared table. Learning to practice compassion, to live compassionately. His teachings remain relevant. If you agree with that, say yes. It's true that he was giving those teachings within a first century Jewish worldview and context. I get that. But the teachings are still valuable. Number two, the passion of Jesus. Look at Luke 4:18-19. Starts off the Gospel of Luke with this announcement by Jesus. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the who? This is something that I wish every Christian would take into account. If what we're preaching is not first and foremost good news to the poor, then we have to at least question whether our Jesus is the same one in the story. I've come to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, the recovery of sight for the blind. And this isn't supernatural here. Yes, there are stories of Jesus healing people who were physically blind. But when he talks about blindness in this context, and when a person was thrown into a Roman jail cell, for most of the time that was just a hole in the ground. You'd be thrown in there, deprived of sunlight. It was so pitch black you couldn't even see your hand in front of your hand in front of your face. It was called prison blindness. The recovery of sight to those that are blind in that context meant simply bringing someone out of captivity, liberation, back into the sunlight. If that makes sense, say yes. For the rest of you, keep working it out. It'll come to you. And to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. That was a Jewish phrase that meant liberation from our foreign oppressors. The year of the Lord's favor. I find it fascinating also, this is a side note, that in Isaiah, where Jesus is quoting from, the next passage is, and the year of God's vengeance. And the way they interpreted that as always the Lord's favor on us, but God's vengeance on our enemies. And Jesus chose to leave that part out. He chose not to read that part. He chose to only announce the favor of God. And he did it not just for Israel, but for Israel's enemies as well. So he's even pushing back against Isaiah a little bit there. But his passion, Jesus lived in a time where the current domination system was seen in the Empire of Rome. The way of orchestrating human societies for as long as we have history that's recorded has always been through some type of domination system. Jesus gave deep critique of human beings seeking to establish order through dominating one another. He also took to task the religious legitimization of that domination system. This is how domination systems work, by the way. Not only do they endeavor to dominate, but they seek to get the stamp of approval by the people's religion as well. In other words, Rome took control of the Jewish temple. They were the ones that determined who the high priests were every year. And there was a level of religious legitimization to the presence of Rome now associated with the temple. If you gave money to support the temple, part of that went to the Empire of Rome as well, whether you liked it or not. We know this to be common in history. After all, when colonialism was at its peak and Europe was taking over the Americas, massacring all of the Native Americans. What did they call it? Does anyone know what they justified that by? What was the theory? Manifest. What is manifest destiny? What does that phrase mean? It means we are killing you and taking away your land because this has been ordained by who? By God. This is God's will. It's always convenient for those in positions of power to be really strong theists. It's the religious legitimization of domination systems. This was taking place. The reason we're talking about this is because this was taking place in Jesus' day, and Jesus spoke to it. This is why Jesus was so anti-temple in his ministry. He wasn't anti-Jewish. Did you hear me say that? See, there's a lot of hatred and violence that has been poured out on our Jewish brothers and sisters because we've forgotten that Jesus was not seeking to replace Judaism. He was speaking within his own Jewish tradition, trying to bring that safer, more compassionate world within his own context. to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor against domination systems, against religious legitimization of those systems. And this is where the passion of Jesus comes out the most. The reason he took these things on is not because he had an interest in politics. It's because he saw other human beings that were being hurt by these things. The passion of Jesus was for people that were being oppressed and marginalized. Stop for a moment once again if you're a theist and let that influence your beliefs about a divine being. That if there is a heart at the center of the universe, let it standing with those that are on the bottom of our society's pyramids and that are on the margins of our exclusive circles. But the real reason why I think Jesus remains relevant and the reason that I'm a Jesus follower today, yes, I have been captivated by the values and ethics of the story. How many would agree, whether you're a theist or not, that the values and ethics of the Jesus story are beautiful? How many would agree with that? They're beautiful. The passion of Jesus is inspiring that he would surround himself with those that were marginalized in his day, call them his new tribe. But the reason I'm a Christian, the way that I define a Christian, the reason that I'm a follower of Jesus today is really because of Jesus' courage. This is what inspires me. Jesus knew where what he was teaching would lead. He knew where his passion for that section of society would lead. He knew that what he was teaching and who he was teaching it for, he knew that would end up costing him his life. And he had the courage to do it anyway. He knew where this would lead and what this would cost him. And he kept on setting a table. And he kept on teaching it. That's the most beautiful part of Jesus for me personally. Anyone else resonate with that? Mark 3:6, very early in Mark's version, says the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. Jesus' predictions that we looked at, Mark 8, 9, and 10, it's not rocket science. People say, well, how did Jesus know they were going to kill him? Well, because he saw it from Mark 3 forward that they wanted to. I mean, in Luke 4, they're trying to take him to the brow of the cliff and throw him off, right? Trust me, if you're going around teaching in favor of those on the margins or those that are at the bottom of society's privileged pyramids, if you're going around preaching that, it'll become quite obvious when people hate you for it. It's not in the dark. So you have these predictions, and then in Mark 11, Mark 11 is where Mark's Jesus story really takes off. This is the last week. It says, when they brought the colt to Jesus, they threw their cloaks over it, and they sat on it. This was to emulate what was prophesied in Zechariah 9. I will take away the war chariots from Ephraim, the war horses from Jerusalem, the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. We saw this in the first presentation this afternoon. Jesus was a preacher of nonviolence. What's fascinating is in verse 9 of Zechariah chapter 9, the verse just previous to this where it talks about him being the bringer of nonviolence, the bringer of peace, it says that their king would enter Jerusalem on a donkey or on a colt. So they go out and they get a colt for Jesus for him to reenact this prophecy from Zechariah of this nonviolent Messiah who would remove violence from the land. And what many miss is that at the same time Jesus was entering this side of Jerusalem on a donkey, this was Sunday. Who else was entering on the other side of Jerusalem at that time? This was the beginning of the Passover week. Who always showed up in Jerusalem to stay in Herod's palace during that holiday? Who was it? Does anyone know? Governor Pilate. Why did Pilate show up every Passover in Jerusalem? Why? Do you know anything about the Passover holiday? What was the Passover holiday about? Liberated from those pagan oppressors. Would that have been seen as a volatile moment for the Roman Empire? So the best way to try to squelch a rebellion, if this holiday escalates and they start thinking this is a new Egypt and a new Moses and a new deliverance and a new Exodus, whether you subscribe to the history of that or not, if they believed it at that time, if this is going to be another Exodus, man, somebody better be down there to squelch that thing before it gets off the ground. So every Passover, Pilate would enter the city on a huge Roman war horse with all of the troops behind him, as if to make a show of force. We are here during this holiday. We are present. And he would stay in Herod's palace, right there by the temple. The same time Pilate was entering on a Roman war steed with all of the soldiers, Jesus on the opposite side of the city through the other gate was coming in on a donkey with his people saying, "Save us now. Save us, Son of David." Do you catch the anti-imperialist message of that comparison? The anti-Roman message. And again, it wasn't because he hated Rome. He hated the people that the Roman system was hurting. He felt for the people that the Roman system was hurting. The very next day, it says actually that day, Jesus entered Jerusalem, and this is important. He went into the temple courts, he looked around at everything, but since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. Why is that so important? Because usually we have Rembrandt's version of Jesus in the temple. It's like Jesus goes into the temple and he notices what's going on for the first time and he just loses it. He has a meltdown. How many have ever heard that version of Jesus cleansing the temple? He just said, there was a huge temper tantrum. That's not exactly what Mark says. Mark says that when he entered into Jerusalem that Sunday evening, the first place he went was where? The temple. He looked around, saw everything, and what did he do? He went back to Bethany at Mary, Martha, and Lazarus' house and spent the night. Why? Because it says it was already late. Anyone know anything about nonviolent demonstrations? Anyone ever participated in activism before or protest? You need witnesses for it to work, am I right? And the best time to do nonviolent protest in the temple was not in the evening when there's nobody there. It was when? In the morning when the place is packed. So he goes back home, spends the night, sleeps on it. This is an impulse. He has a good night's sleep on his plans. This is so, it's done with intention. Comes back the next morning, walks in the temple, then overturns the tables. Why? Herb, I thought you said Jesus was nonviolent. Yeah, I didn't say passive. To quote the Black Lives Matter movement, Jesus in the temple shut it down. That's what he was doing. And I think it was for many reasons. There's many parallels in this that we could get, and we could spend all day talking about this. But those who have practiced nonviolence have seen in this the first step, the step one of how to bring world change, to move us towards more compassion towards one another. The first thing you have to do is provoke the system. Gandhi looked at the cleansing of the temple. The temple, remember, this was the religious legitimization of the Roman system. Gandhi saw this as step one. He mimicked this in South Africa. Does anyone know how Gandhi mimicked the cleansing of the temple in South Africa? He chose to tear up the South African passports that Indians chose to were forced to carry. And in doing that, how did the government there respond, violently or nonviolently? Violently. How did Gandhi respond in response? Respond in response. Forgive the redundancy there. Nonviolently, that's right. Did it produce change? He said, I learned it from the temple story. Jesus went in, overturned the money tables, disrupted the system, shut it down, and how did they respond? Your Jesus has a rap record, by the way. It was the temple police that came and arrested him Thursday night. It's a rap sheet. Your Jesus has gone to jail for protesting. I need to say this because we have such a conventional American view of Jesus. Jesus went to jail for protest. That's how much he cared about the people that were being hurt. Gandhi went to back to India. There was the Great Salt Marches. How many know that story? The cleansing of the temple. Step number two, how did they respond? Violently or nonviolently? One of the most horrific days of Gandhi's nonviolent history was the response of the British government to the salt marches that day. The inhumanity of man to man. It betrayed, it unveiled the system, it tore back the mask and created change. How did they respond to that violence? Violently or nonviolently? Nonviolently. King studied this. By the way, stop for a moment and ponder. Why was it that a Baptist minister in the Bible Belt had to go to a brown-skinned Hindu to discover the teachings of Jesus? Wrestle with that. King came back with these same stories, and he translated temple cleansing into what did it look like here? How about bus boycotts? How about freedom rides? How about sit-ins? Many of you, I think, yeah, many of you lived during those days. This was all patterned after a strategic pattern that they saw in the Jesus story. How did the systems respond? Violently or nonviolently? Violently. And King said it is important that if you're going to march, first prerequisite is that you must not view them as your enemy. They are victims, too, of systemic injustice. And they need saved just as much as we do. Because we must respond to their violence. We must match their capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure such suffering. And he was patterning this all after this story. And it did bring some change. The next day, Tuesday, this is when they realized he had told this parable. Jesus shows up at the temple again. He starts teaching all day, but now he's teaching against the religious leadership of the day. And when they realized that this parable was against them, they wanted to do what? Arrest him, but they what? See, this is what I want. I want to zero in on this because I think the Jesus story can be misunderstood in a way that's dangerous for a people group on this planet. Realize the reason it took the religious leadership 4 days to arrest Jesus is because at this stage the Jewish people loved Jesus. Do you see that? It was the Jewish listeners there at the temple who were protecting Jesus from the religious leadership. So this is not, there's so much anti-Judaism still in our culture today. And I want us to understand, Jesus was not anti-Jewish. Amen? He was trying to address injustices that existed within Judaism. Just as much as if he were today a Christian, he would try to solve injustices that are among us. Or he was a Buddhist, he would try to do that there. Or if he was a Hindu, he would do that there. Or if he was a Muslim, he would do it in Islam. My favorite thing about the crucifixion story, not the last week, but the crucifixion story especially, is the very last part of Mark, and it's mentioned in all three Gospels. When anything shows up three times in the Gospels, take note of it. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion stood there in front of Jesus and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was Son of God. Do not think Nicene Creed, second member of the Godhead here. For a Roman to say, certainly he's the Son of God, who was that title reserved for in Rome? Caesar. What he's saying is, certainly this dove is greater than the eagle, is what he's saying. There's a paradigm shift happening in this Roman centurion. But what I want you to also notice is this story element, story detail of this curtain being ripped from top to bottom. What's that about? Well, here was the religious system of the Jewish people. Remember, a religious system that was legitimizing the oppression of Rome. And the people that got hit by that the hardest were the poor. The economic oppression of that system was horrendous. And remember, the temple's at the heart of it. And the way the temple worked was the Gentiles could come this far, right? Then the Jewish women could come this far. Then the Jewish men could come this far. Then a select group of men could come in this far. And then only one man could go all the way into the heart of this system. And then only once a year. Because who was present? Who was at the heart of that system? Now, step into the cultural context. This is supposed to be the Shekinah, the presence of God at the heart of this system. That's what's within the veil. And this is a religious system at the heart of the Jewish community that's also legitimizing whose presence there? Roman's oppression. Has that ever happened within other oppressive systems where they take over the religious system of whomever they conquer and they use that to legitimize their presence there? How many have seen that happen in history over and over? Religion has been used over and over like this. This isn't a Jewish problem, it's a human problem. It can happen to anyone. And when Jesus died, the story says, that's why it's my favorite part, that curtain was rent. From top to bottom. What's the story truth here? That means from the single high priest all the way back to the last Gentile who could all together look all the way down finally into that most holy place. And when that curtain was rent, what did they see in that most holy place? Anyone know? The ark had been long lost. The presence had long departed. Anybody here ever seen The Wizard of Oz? When you pull back the veil, the wizard is just a man. They looked all the way down to the heart of the system. And what was there? Nothing but an empty realm. Because in the story, where was the presence at that moment? In the one being shamefully suspended on a Roman cross at the hands of that oppression system and the legitimization of that religious temple. He was being executed for standing in solidarity with the oppressed and teaching a shared table. He was being executed for it. That's in the story where the presence was. Now, they didn't realize that at first. Because on Friday night, the story just looks like here's just another failed attempt at trying to change the world. Somebody stood up to the system, and what does the system do every time? Gandhi was assassinated. Cain was too. Just another failed attempt, but the story doesn't stop there. Mark 16, this is where Mark's story ends. Sunday morning, the ladies go to the tomb. This is when they look up, they saw the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, take your naturalistic worldview for a moment and shelf it. In other words, your naturalistic scientific worldview, your mind right now is going to start arguing with the story details here and say, well, how can that be true? I don't want to be misunderstood here. Nobody asks whether or not Cinderella is a true story. They ask, what's the point of the story? Are you with me? Pause your historical criticism for a moment of the story and ask yourself, what's the story truth here? Here's a man who's been executed by the status quo. By the way, Christianity is the only major world religion whose central figure was executed by the status quo. Our central figure of worship was executed by the domination system. That's a claim to fame, sorry. That's pretty cool. But what's the story truth here? They entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Don't be alarmed, he said. You're looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has what? Risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him? Go. Tell his disciples and Peter, he's going on ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. And this is where the earlier versions of Mark end. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out, fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And that's where the story ends in the earliest versions of Mark. Other people thought that's not a very fitting ending, but that's how his original version ended. Why? Luke gives us a little bit more of a clue into what's the underlying point. Luke's version has him saying, has the witnesses saying, why do you look for the living among the dead? He's not here. He is what? What's the story truth here? Here's a system that was saying God was on the side of the oppressors. Here's the one that was executed for standing up against them. And God has done what? Brought him back to life. In other words, God's not on that side. The temple veil was rent. God is on this side. Now, don't misunderstand me. Does God love everyone? Does God want to transform everyone? So don't misunderstand me. But in this story, the God of this story, though that God loves everyone, he takes the side of the oppressed and the marginalized. And he calls those who are oppressing and marginalizing to join him on that side. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor. Yes, he loved the rich man, but he's calling him away from that to embrace standing with those that are being hurt. Think of it for a moment this way. What would have happened if Martin Luther King had come back to life 3 days later? Just imagine that for a moment. Imagine that with me. If Martin Luther King had come back to life 3 days later, would that have changed the world? This is what's transpiring in the first century. Whether you believe it happened this way or not, you have to at least see that they thought they saw this Jesus come back to life. They had encountered something that made them make a radical shift in how they were thinking, perceiving the world, and wanting to live. They began to promote the Jesus story because they believed that, yes, the system killed him, but here's the good news. He's come back to life. God has raised him from the dead. And this calls into question the gospel that we teach today. If Martin Luther King Jr. had been, if he had come back to life, no one would be going around saying, hear the good news, Martin Luther King died for you. Is that what they'd be proclaiming? What would they be proclaiming? Have you heard the good news? King's alive. How many can see that would be good news? No one would be thankful that King had died. They'd be thankful that King was alive. And this is where we miss it. Today, Christianity has replaced the gospel of the first century. Jesus died for you so you can go to heaven. That's the Christian gospel today. That's not the gospel of the book of Acts. In the book of Acts, Jesus doesn't die so you can go to heaven. Jesus died because he stood up to the status quo. That's why he died. And the good news is that God has undone and reversed everything that was accomplished in his death and brought him back to life. He's not dead. He has risen. Even a rich man's tomb couldn't stop him. He's still out there. The revolution lives on. He's still out there recruiting. Come, follow me. There's still a shared table. We can still change the world. That's inspiring, isn't it? I mean, I think it's at least a cool story. It's at least a cool story. In Luke 13, 32 through 33, we tell you the good news that what God promised our ancestors, he has fulfilled for us. What was the promise to the ancestors? But that one day Messiah would come and all injustice, all violence, all bloodshed, all oppression would be made right. How many still long for a world that looks like that? And their call was, the God of our ancestors has fulfilled this for us, their children, not by Jesus dying, but by what? By raising Jesus back to life. Finally, their God had stepped in and said, no more. The prophets are going to start coming back to life. New world has begun. And however you explain scientifically how this happened, the historical facts are there was a small movement that began from this story that began to grow exponentially, that was rooted in nonviolent enemy love, formed in the shape of a shared table that began its first work of liberation and standing with the oppressed by eliminating poverty, at least among themselves. How many are beginning to look at the Jesus story a little differently this weekend? How many are seeing it through a different lens? I want us to see it has much more to do about this world than helping you get to another one. If you can agree with that, say yes. And what it should inspire us to do is to follow that Jesus, to teach the things that he taught, to be passionate about the people that he was passionate for. And it should inspire us with courage, no longer to fear death. What is death really? I mean, if you're an Adventist, you don't believe you're really aware that you're dead. Are you with me? I mean, really, we fear it going into it, but once we get there, you're not really going to miss yourself. And I'm thankful for the first century Christians who died with the hope of a resurrection. Jesus' resurrection enabled them to no longer fear death, because death is how the system keeps people under their thumb. Do what we say or else. And they're like, fine, do it. We're going to change the world through embracing that. But I'm also reminded of people like Martin Luther King Jr., for those of you who are naturalists in the room. Martin Luther King Jr. was also a secular humanist naturalist. And he did not die believing that he would one day see the world he was working to create. But in the last 2 months of his life, knew it was coming. And he considered that giving that to his children was of value enough, even if he himself would never see it. And he would not let them silence his voice. So regardless of where you are on your worldview, how many can see there's still relevance, at least in the Jesus story? How many can see that? And lastly, once again, if you are a theist, how many of you can see the potential for this to change the God, your perception of the God you believe in? How many can see that? Because you will become, those of you who are theists in the room, you will become the kind of God you worship. Yes, I know your stories speak of a God who created you in his image, but we have not failed to return the favor ever since. you will become the kind of God you worship. I encourage you, if you're going to believe in a God that looks like Jesus. Believe in a God who's passionate for the oppressed and hurting, whom people are using the Torah against. A God who inspired the teachings of Jesus. A God in whom those teachings originated. And a God who is in Christ, standing in solidarity with the broken and spilled out, and proved it by bringing Jesus back to life. Today, I believe it's important because we have modern pyramids of oppression, don't we? With religious legitimization. Could we name any of them? Do we have the courage to do that this afternoon? Do we have the courage? Is that too divisive? Should I not do that? I mean, people always say, Herb, don't do anything too, because you want them to come back to the next presentation. Have a good night. Let me just be real, because our time is already limited this afternoon, and I know you're tired. I can't do this in all churches. I try. Sometimes I pull it off, sometimes I don't. But I can at least say this in this church, because this church has a history. We could talk about gender, we could talk about race, we could talk about economics. But I think nowhere is this more obvious today than in the marginalization and the oppression of the LGBTQ community in our nation today. That is a group that is being marginalized and oppressed with religious legitimization. I think the Jesus story could speak into that a little bit. Anyone with me? When Constantine became, when he embraced Christianity and made Christianity the empire religion, the teachings of Jesus overnight became marginalized. Now what defined you as a Christian is whether or not you believed in story details. Anyone ever heard of the Apostles' Creed? How does it go? Born of a Virgin Mary, crucified under Pontius Pilate. Did they skip anything between those two story details? Yeah, how about the life and teachings of the man, right? But that didn't matter anymore. Just, do you believe in the story details? I find it fascinating today that my dearly loved atheist friends endeavor to disprove Christianity, and it's our fault, by showing the lack of historical credibility of the story details. That's typically the critique. Do you really believe in a virgin birth? Do you really believe in the resurrection? Do you really believe those things happened? How many have heard those arguments before, and how many would agree they have some weight? I'm not downplaying them. What I'm saying is, shame on us that creates a religion that's based on believing story details rather than a set of values and ethics. Shame on us, because there are four Gospels. And you know how many mention the virgin birth? One. You know what that means? The other three Gospel authors thought you could become a Jesus follower through his story without you even knowing about a virgin birth. What does that tell you? But do you know what all four of the Gospels do have? The values and ethical teachings of Jesus. Because before Constantine, do you know what defined a Christian? Are you endeavoring to try and live the teachings of this Jesus in a trajectory towards this new world? That's what it meant to follow Jesus, or to be a Christian. But after Constantine, you did away with the teachings, because now you wanted to kill people, to empire and all of that, and forgive me. But and so now what defined you as a Christian is, well, do you believe in virgin birth? Do you believe in And give it long enough, we stop worrying about fixing anything down here, and all we want to do is escape everything down here. So Christianity morphs into believe enough story details so that you can be assured you'll go to heaven when you die, but it's not going to change much now. You tell people you're going to become a Christian, they say, well, that's nice, dear. Because really all it means is you're going to have a few hours taken out of your schedule once a week. Go back to West Virginia, tell people you're going to become a Christian. They'll say, oh, how sweet. Bless your heart. Tell people in West Virginia you're going to become a vegan. They'll have a meltdown. Don't do that! God forgive us for domesticating Jesus to the degree that becoming a follower of Jesus, that becoming a vegan is more life-changing than following Jesus. I think Jesus' teachings need a revival. Because those teachings teach us to view, if you once again do believe in a God, they teach you to believe in that God radically differently. They call you to look at yourself radically differently. And they call you to look at everyone else around you radically differently. And the passion of Jesus. I long for a group of Jesus followers who are passionate about the marginalized, rather than being the ones marginalizing them. If Jesus were still in the tomb, he'd be rolling over in it. I believe the Jesus story says there's a heart at the center of the universe that beats quite differently than what many religious folks have assumed. And if you've been hurt by the religion that bears Jesus' name, as a Christian, I just want to tell you, I'm sorry. And I'm not saying you need to be part of us. I am saying that I would like to enter into relationship with you and hear from you how my theology has hurt you so that I could follow Jesus more better, more deeply. I meant what I said last night. The closest I will ever come to God in this life is you. So I need you to show me my blind spot. May we all have the courage of Jesus. The shared table, scary, isn't it? Be honest. It's scary for both sides. You know why? Because everyone who comes to the shared table changes. Everybody does. We come to the shared table radically different from one another, and those differences call us to listen and to look at life through the lens of someone else, to see to just the golden rule itself, doing unto others as we would have them do to us, calls us to put ourselves in their position, does it not? And you cannot help but be changed when you do that. Again, they killed him, but God brought him back to life. He's still out there. They couldn't stop him. He's still recruiting. Come follow me. Any questions this afternoon? Anything I've covered this weekend that you have questions about?
Thank you once again for listening. If you'd like to support the work of Renewed Heart Ministries, you can do so at renewedheartministries.com by clicking on the link Donate. Or you can sign up for our free monthly newsletter where you'll be given the opportunity to support us by mail. Again, we do not believe in monetizing the teachings of Jesus. Therefore, we are solely dependent on the contributions of our supporters. Jesus, we believe, said it best when he said, "Freely you've received, freely give." And we want to do just that. And to each one of you who are already presently supporting Renewed Heart Ministries, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you. Together, we are making a difference. Wherever this finds you today, keep living in love as we together are endeavoring to put into practice the teachings of Jesus till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Thank you once again for listening.